And now I will turn the podium over to Susan Cheflin. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie, for your leadership, and thank you for the candle lighting this morning. We now come to the part of our service where we say together our affirmation. Love is the spirit of this fellowship. This is our great covenant to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth and love, and to help one another. And now I'm going to light the chalice, and it is very symbolic, the idea of light for Mary Oliver. In one of her poems, which I will be reading later on this morning, she says, make of yourself a light. So let me light the chalice with that thought in mind. We are now going to begin with the first hymn, which is going to be done by Pam Parker and Jim Neininger. And it is significant to Mary Oliver because she so exemplifies the interconnected web of all living things. So Pam and Jim. And now we are going to have that wonderful moment when we all turn and greet each other and shake hands and say hello, glad you're here, and just share in fellowship. So everybody greet everybody. And if you have colds, you may rub elbows. I remember doing this once at a talk that I gave, of all places. It was Ohio State University, and there must have been about 100 people in the audience, and it took about 15 minutes to get it under control. But now we are going to have our responsive reading, which is one of our Mary Oliver readings, Wild Geese, number 490. So So number 490 in your book, one of the most often quoted of Mary Oliver's poems, Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves.
Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine.
Meanwhile, the world goes on.
Meanwhile, the sun and the dreary petals of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies, over the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers.
Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again.
Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world rolls itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, and has a secret place in the family of things.
All right, at this point, we have our time of sharing and joys of concern, and I believe that people who wish to have a joy or concern line up on either side to come forward and light a candle. So if you would, and we do that, I think, with the microphone, right?
I'm Pam Wheeler, and this is a candle of concern for my coworker and friend, Dawn, who 2-3 weeks ago found out she was pregnant with twins and then had to make the very difficult decision after finding out the pregnancy was not viable of terminating it. So we're all thinking about her and her time at home and her husband, John.
Hi, my name is Eric Larrabee. My joy is that on Thursday, my lovely wife Jennifer celebrated the 13th anniversary of her 29th birthday. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Pam Parker. I'm also one of the adult advisors for our youth group. Our youth group works through YAC, Youth Adult Committee, which involves congregations in New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. And some of our adult advisors attended GA, which is General Assembly, which is the annual meeting of all congregations throughout the country. And one came back with a very interesting social action that they would like us all to be aware of, and the youth would like the adult community to be aware of, which is what's going on in Arizona with the Mexican-American Studies Program. Some of you may have heard about the banned books. It's sort of a shorthand for what's going on. There was a law passed 2 years ago that came into effect that essentially has put the nix on the Mexican-American Studies Program that had been sort of a hallmark of the Arizona commitment to deal with the federal injunction to stop desegregation. The law says that it's illegal for a charter or school to promote the overthrow of the United States government, promote resentment towards a race or class of people, any study that's designed primarily for pupils of a particular ethnic group, or that advocates ethnic solidarity instead of the treatment of pupils as individuals. So this is now what's against the law in Arizona. Today, the UU humanists are beginning an invitation to congregations to do something to raise the awareness of what's happening among ourselves, among our community. They're calling it 50 for the Freedom to Read. This is in response to what the Tucson district did, which was in order to not lose $14 million of state support, withdrew their Mexican-American studies and took books for those studies out of the classroom. That's why they're calling it the banned books program. Anyway, what I'm going to do for this is put up some of the material that was given to me by the people at YAC, including the UU Humanists flyer for this. Next week, Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, there is that's Tuesday and Wednesday. There will be on television on WLIW a program called Precious Knowledge, which addresses this issue. And I would like to bring to the board and discuss further how we can do something as a congregation, perhaps have a screening of this for the community and make a statement or find some way to let this not be forgotten, let this not be ignored by the rest of the country, because it's very frightening when that kind of censorship comes under the aegis of law. And I will give these to Leslie to put up on the bulletin board.
Any other joys and concerns to be shared this morning? Then I light this candle for all of those joys and concern that have been unspoken but are felt among us. And now we would like to have a children's message, and I think rather than moving the table, if the children would come forward just right here, if that would be okay. We're going to have a quick little message before you go upstairs. So if you want to gather around here. Can you all fit in over there? Okay, I'm going to first pass the microphone around. I'm Susan, so I'm going to pass the microphone around and just ask you each to say who you are.
I'm Ilea.
Aiden.
Tali.
Franny.
Viano.
Okay, I had a little question in the program, and it said, what is your favorite thing in nature? So I hope you had a little chance to think about it. Before you get started, I just want to give a little introduction to what's going to happen downstairs today. We're going to be talking about a lady who is a very strong observer of nature. She really goes out, and she looks at trees, and she looks at flowers, and she looks at animals, and she studies them, and she really pays attention to them, and she talks to them. So given that thought in mind, would you like to share what some of your favorite things are in nature? Aiden, did you?
Finding new animals.
All right. Anybody else have something in nature they like?
I just like it when it's outside and it's like night and you hear all the crickets and everything like that, and it's really peaceful. If there's like no city lights around or anything like that, you can see the stars. So
you'd be happy to know that our poet has a poem that she's written about crickets.
Like picking vegetables off plants.
Okay. Any others? Do you think it's possible to talk to things in nature? Do you think? This is a daisy. Do you think it's possible for me to talk to this daisy? What do you think? You can say anything you want. Think it would be crazy? Do you think I would be crazy? Well, I feel like this is a living thing here, and we could spend time looking at this flower and talking with this flower, and actually some people do talk to their plants to help make them grow and make them healthier. So I guess what I want to leave with you today, or have you think about today, is that there is so much in this world that we live in, so many living things, plants, trees, animals of all kinds, crickets, vegetables, all growing living things. And we can relate to them as living things and really be with them, experience them, and pay attention to them. So I'm hoping that you will all, as you go out walking in the woods or wherever you are, think about living things and pay attention to them. Okay? All right. We're going to sing you out now. Thank you.
Now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. Now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go.
All right. Well, if this Daisy starts talking during the service, we'll have to answer back. We'll hope the mic picks it up. All right. Next on our program today, we are going to have our offering, and this is for the benefit and welfare of our fellowship. So let me pass the baskets around, and we have a song to be shared, Rise and Shine. Tell me, what is it that you want to do with your wild and precious life, with your one wild and precious life? That's the question that Mary Oliver asks us, when I thought about doing this program, I realized that I have spent the last 25 years of my life with the words and the poems of Mary Oliver. I first discovered Mary Oliver in Cape Cod in 1986. Ernie and I spend almost every summer in Cape Cod and in Provincetown particularly. And in the Provincetown bookstore, I happened to find a book called Dream Work. And I took it to the beach, head of the meadow, sat in that wild vastness, looking out at the ocean, which looks as though it would go on forever, and first discovered Mary Oliver's words. It was the beginning for me of a journey, a spiritual journey, of discovering my life and who I was. Very interestingly, just about a year after that, I walked in these doors for the first time in 1987 and began a spiritual journey here. And the two of them have seemed to have woven themselves together over these last 25 years, my life here in this fellowship and my life reading the words of Mary Oliver, being in Cape Cod in Provincetown, which is her environment and the place which has been such an inspiration for so many of her poems. So the two are sort of inextricably intertwined, and in thinking about the influence that she's had on my thought, my growth, my connection to the spiritual, I thought that it would be a good thing to think of why the Unitarian Universalists have adopted her. And I don't think way back then they had. Now, of course, she's published by Beacon Press, which is the Unitarian Universalist Press. And she likes that publisher and they've been publishing most of her books for the last many years. So the connection, what is the connection with Mary Oliver and Unitarian Universalism? One of the most basic that I see is this great reverence she has for this life, this world that we live in, and all interconnected things. As Franny said about the cricket, there is a wonderful poem, which I think I may be going to read in one of the things I'm reading today, about a cricket. She writes about every living thing. She pays attention to every living thing. And her part of her mission, part of her goal, is to really observe, to pay attention, and to see life, both in its beauty and in its terror. So the first poem that I'm thinking of that connects to this idea of paying attention is called Mindful. And this is Mary Oliver. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclimation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. So Mary Oliver calls us to pay attention to the world. She challenges us not to waste our life in meaningless mindlessness. So many times we turn on the TV, we're on the computer, we're doing all of these things, and we're not really paying attention to what we're seeing around us. She asks us to delve into the beauty and see the beauty of the world. And her work touches on the reverence that we hold for these interconnected things that are part of our world. So why do we think of Mary Oliver as our poet laureate? There's so much on the internet about this. I was surprised to find that there were so many people debating this question. And some people think that it's because her poems are so simple that you can get them within the context of a worship service, and you don't have to think three or four times about what she's saying. It just comes across that way. Some believe that it's can be easily contained within the framework of our service, as opposed to, say, a more complex poet or a poem which has to be read many times to be understood. However, I think there's a deceiving simplicity in Mary Oliver's poems, because her words do address a very deep mystery in the universe. And all of the things that we need to consider every day when we think about what is the meaning of our life. The writer Stephen Dobbins said in a New York Times article, "For Mary Oliver, one lives by trying to learn how to love the world. Many of her poems have as a subtext the teaching of how one lives." And he gives an example of that as the Buddha's last instruction. And here is the poem, the Buddha's last instruction. "Make of yourself a light," said the Buddha, before he died. "I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness to send up the first signal, the white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two sala trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen, even before the sun itself hangs detached in the blue air. I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly I'm not needed, yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd." So I believe that this poem illustrates and captures that Mary Oliver's poems are about light. They're about that thing within us and with all living things that illuminates. And her poems sustain us. Having discovered that first book, Dreamwork, in Provincetown, and continuing to study Mary Oliver over all the years, I just brought a few. Okay, I will say, every time I go to Provincetown, which is every summer, I buy one or two, and she autographs them. So many of these are autographed. And this summer, I bought this book, which is her story about her partner that she lived with in Provincetown for many years, who died in 2005. Mary Malone Cook, who is a photographer, and she's done this beautiful book. So in this is Mary Oliver's signature, and I talked to the woman in the Provincetown bookstore as I was checking out, and I said, "I'm going to do a talk at my fellowship on Mary Oliver." And she said, "Do you have an autographed copy?" And I said, "Yes, I do. There's her autograph right in here." And she said, "You know, she doesn't like to be interviewed. She doesn't like to talk about her poetry." And I said, "I think I've gathered that from some things I've read about her." And then the woman said, "But I feel very honored because I get to go to her house and take the copies of the books to be signed. So I get to see her." And she is a very retiring and a very shy person, and she doesn't like to be seen. And as Gretchen will testify from her having been at the at our assembly, the Unitarian Universalist Assembly in 2006 to read, Gretchen said she did inform the audience that if anyone took her picture, she would walk off the stage. So you can be sure that no one took her picture, right, Gretchen?
Correct.
All right, so nobody took her picture because they knew that she didn't want to be photographed. So she's a very private person, but however, I have managed, and I didn't even bring all of the books that I have. Couldn't carry them all. I left some of them back at home. And what I found when I started working on this program is they are stuffed full of programs from this fellowship where we've read her poetry, notes that people have written to me about her, notes that I've written to other people about her, articles of every possible description, cards. It's just full of a whole life, those 25 years worth of Mary Oliver books. I don't think I have any other poetry books that are so full of having shared Mary Oliver with other people and having people share Mary Oliver with me. Notes to friends where I've copied a poem and said, think you would like this, you know, maybe you'll enjoy this poem. So I guess I'm a Mary Oliver groupie. Diane Ackerman, who is a wonderful nature writer, calls Mary Oliver an earth ecstatic, which I love that, earth ecstatic, because I really felt as I took this album, Blackwater Pond, and I listened to it in the car all week in preparation for this, over and over and over and over. And finally, I have to say, Friday, I came home from work, and I rushed into the house, and I said, I'm having an ecstatic moment, and I rushed back outside and hugged our tree. At which my husband said, I hope an ant crawls up your pants leg. But that did not deter me because I was going to have my moment of ecstasy in nature. And Mary Oliver produced that after all of that listening to the poems. So Diane Ackerman calls her an earth ecstatic, a contemplative writer who finds joy and wisdom in sustained attentiveness to nature. Her beloved birds, dogs, snakes, and ocean are all summoned to capture the breathtaking glory of life. So is there anything she doesn't admire other than people who are trying to photograph her? Let me have her tell the story in the poem, Hum. Hum. What is this dark hum among the roses? The bees have gone simple, sipping. That's all. What did you expect? Sophistication? They're small creatures, and they are filling their bodies with sweetness. How could they not moan in happiness? The little worker bee lives, I have read, about 3 weeks. Is that long? Long enough, I suppose, to understand that life is a blessing. I have found them, haven't you? Stopped in the very cups of the flowers, their wings a little tattered, so much flying about to the hive and then out into the world, then back and perhaps dancing. Should be the task to be a scout, sweet, dancing bee. I think there isn't anything in this world I don't admire. If there is, I don't know what it is. I haven't met it yet, nor expect to. The bee is small, and since I wear glasses so I can see the traffic and read books, I have to take them off and bend close to study and understand what is happening. It's not hard. It's, in fact, as instructive as anything I've ever studied. Plus, too, it's love almost too fierce to endure. The bee nuzzling like that into the blouse of the rose and the fragrance and the honey and, of course, the sun. The purely pure sun shining all the while over all of us. So, Mary Oliver as Unitarian Universalist Poet Laureate, she articulates for us the values that we hold, our reverence for all living things, and our idea of what we think God might be, which is so difficult for many of us to speak of and to articulate. I think of the issue, and I'm sure that perhaps you all read the issue in UU World, the summer UU World, called Primal Reverence. This is by Kendall Gibbons. But what took my notice here is that she's giving us examples of when we've found ecstasy and this primal reverence in nature. And she gives examples such as you stand at the shore with the waves beating their rhythmic crash, the distances suggest infinity, the ocean's unfathomable depth and power, its ceaseless force and mystery, the oneness of life emerging from the sea's embrace. Or she gives the example, perhaps for you, the stars at night, somewhere beyond the reach of the city lights. Or perhaps your taste runs to the forest. So she's describing ways in which we can find this primal reverence, the kind of thing that Franny, I think, meant when she was talking about listening to the crickets outside at night and the kind of sound that makes. I think each one of us, if we think about some moment that we've had a sense of really connecting with this universal love, power, that we can think of a moment. I mean, I can think of moments in a at the ocean or in the middle of a pine forest when I've had that sense of incredible holiness, as though I were in a temple. So that's, I think, part of what Mary Oliver brings to us. I'm thinking, and I think I mentioned this perhaps when to the children when I was talking about the flower and talking to the flower. I don't know how many of you remember this speaker that we used to have come once in a while. His name was Dr. Anthony Padovano, and he gave many talks here. And one of the things that struck me once was he talked about a photographer that he knew who went out and sat and studied a flower for 2 or more hours before he would even begin to photograph the flower, to really understand and get into the flower and be able to understand the flower. So part of that is really this intense observation that's part of what Mary Oliver does, and paying attention. She calls us to the world around us, and she knows that as much as we study it, we are never going to unravel the mystery of it. This becomes understandable in a poem that she has called Bone. And I relate to this poem strongly because walking on the beach, and Ernie knows this, every summer I bring back all these shells and bones and seaweed and all kinds of things which gather in the house, memories of things that I found at the ocean. But she's walking along the ocean and she finds this little bone, which is the ear bone of a whale that she imagines had been dead for many years. Bone. Understand, I am always trying to figure out what the soul is and where hidden and what shape. And so last week, when I found on the beach the ear bone of a pilot whale that may have died hundreds of years ago, I thought maybe I was close to discovering something. For the ear bone is the portion that lasts longest in any of us, man or whale, shaped like a squat spoon with a pink scoop where once, in the lively swimmer's head, it joined its two sisters in the house of hearing. It was only 2 inches long, and I thought the soul might be like this, so hard, so necessary, yet almost nothing. Beside me, the gray sea was opening and shutting its wave doors, unfolding over and over, its time-ridiculing roar. I looked, but I couldn't see anything through its dark-knit glare. Yet don't we all know the golden sand is there at the bottom, though our eyes have never seen it, nor can our hands ever catch it? Lest we would sift it down into fractions and facts, certainties, and what the soul is also, I believe I will never quite know, though I play at the edges of knowledge, knowing, truly, I know that our part is not knowing, but looking and touching and loving, which is the way I walked on softly through the pale pink morning light. I come now to part of the talk about Mary Oliver confronting death. And I just have a little anecdote to tell about an experience on Friday. As I said, I've been listening to this all week in the car. So I had it on full blast. I turned the car off, and a couple of my colleagues and I were going someplace, so I said, I'll drive. They jumped into the car, and I turned the car on. It wasn't planned, and I didn't even realize I'd turned it off there. But this booming voice comes out saying, when death comes. And the two of them got so hysterical. They said, what are you listening to? Is this the stuff you listen to on the way to work in the morning? It's no wonder you're so depressed and so upset. Why do you listen to this stuff? And I thought to myself, I wish I could explain this. I wish I could explain that this is not maudlin, horrible, awful stuff about death and dying. This is a poem about affirmation. But I couldn't go into it, and I didn't have enough time to say that when death comes is not a bad thing. It is part of Mary Oliver's struggle with part of the terrifying things in our universe, not just the nice little flowers that are very safe and grow like this, but also some of the more terrifying aspects of life. So I will share with you when death comes and then see if it's as fearful as we might think it is. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps his purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does toward silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was a bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So Mary Oliver says in her, she's written a couple of handbooks about writing poetry and about poetry. She says, a mind that is lively and inquiring, compassionate, curious, full of music, is a mind full of possible poetry. Poetry is a life-cherishing force, and it requires a vision, a faith. Poems are not words, but fires for the cold, ropes let down to the lost, something as necessary as bread in the pockets of the hungry. The statement that I put at the top of the order today is, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles, it's in the imagination. And I wanted to just place that in a context and in a framework for what I believe it means. And I think you need to see it in a context to get the feeling for what it's talking about in terms of heaven. And she does mention in this poem Mrs. Blake, who of course is the wife of William Blake, the great mystic poet. So this poem is called The Swan. Across the wide waters, something comes floating, a slim and delicate ship filled with white flowers. It moves on its miraculous muscles as though time didn't exist, as though bringing such gifts to the dry shore was a happiness, almost beyond bearing. And now it turns its dark eyes and rearranges the clouds of its wings. It trails an elaborate webbed foot, the color of charcoal. Soon it will be here. Oh, what shall I do when that poppy-colored beak rests in my hand? Said Mrs. Blake of the poet, I miss my husband's company. He is so often in paradise. Of course, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which you perceive this world and the gestures with which you honor it. Oh, what will I do? What will I say when those white wings touch the shore? I recall one summer when we went to Cape Cod. I loved to go down to the beach very early in the morning. I was there just a little bit after sunrise and sitting there writing some notes and looking out at the water. And these two gorgeous white swans just picked up out of the water and just flew over my head. It was a most inspiring moment and brought me back to this poem of Mary Oliver's. She asks us to pay attention to the world we live in. We like her, I believe we Unitarian Universalists like her, because she gives a voice to our theology. She expresses the deepest meanings of life. She explores the mystery of the universe without any connection to rite and ritual. She is our UU saint. So Mary Oliver, our UU saint, said, there is only one subject worthy of my attention, the spiritual side of the world. What I mean by spirituality is not theology, but attitude. So I'd like to conclude with one final poem, The Summer Day. And I believe that it brings us back to my original question to you when we started. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and all too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? All right, now I'd like to open it up to any feedback that any of you have or any comments that you would like to make about any of these matters or any other matters.
So listening to Mary Oliver and her reverence, it reminded me of some of the opportunities I had when I was young. My mother's parents very wisely back in 1949 bought land up in the Poconos. And away from everything, away from lights, away from the closest thing was another dairy farm a mile across the valley, and I remember being up there for weeks on end during summers and just kind of being able to observe the natural pace of things. And the night that I remember most was it had the place had this beautiful, broad, open sky. And I sat in this field, and after having pinpointed where it would happen, I watched Skylab, for those old enough to remember that, this little white point of light go from one side of the horizon to the other. And it gave me a sense of perspective in where I fit in, that in all of this vastness, there's one little white dot, how many miles up in orbit, that represented humanity and where we fit into everything. And I just remember lying on my back. I can vividly remember lying on my back in that field, getting wet and watching that dot go from one side of the sky to the other. And I think that's one of the things that kind of kept my focus to the point where do we fit in? Where is our part in it? And Mary Oliver's, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious life? It to me, it's a question of perspective, and that all links together for me.
First, I just want to say thank you for this wonderful talk. This was mm-hmm. really very, very nice. And it just brought home to me how I feel that at least with a great amount of poetry, it never really is completely alive until someone is reading it out loud and the music can be experienced. And I think you do a brilliant job, and I really appreciate you sharing this with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Susan. I really got to feel like I got to sit with Mary Oliver for the first time, even though I've heard her stuff before and read some of it. But I found myself thinking, on the one hand, she lived an incredibly privileged life on so many levels. But within that context, she also, in order to live her life and produce what she produced, and required an extraordinary degree of commitment and courage. And I think I'm coming away feeling a sense of the enormity of that courage.
I didn't mention too much about the biography of her life, but she wasn't a wealthy person. She took ordinary jobs that she didn't have to think about, jobs where that she didn't like, because she wanted to be able to focus on writing. So she was not a wealthy person. She just made enough. Sometimes she and her partner would just, one time the dog came back with a fish, and that was their supper. The dog caught the fish in out of the pond or whatever. So she wasn't a wealthy person, but yes, you're right. She did have a privileged life. Jim?
Thanks. Yeah, part of what I was going to ask was a little bit more about her personal history or background. You mentioned she's a very private person, and I was wondering, in her poems, does she ever glorify humankind or do a poem about a person as opposed to just plants or non-human animals?
Very good question. She does not write very much about people. She has one poem. There's a friend I have in New York City who doesn't like her poems because it's not social activist. She doesn't. There's only one poem that my friend likes, and that's the one she writes about finding a woman. She's in an Asian. She's going to Asia, and she's in an airport restroom, and she sees a poor woman kneeling down by the toilet bowl cleaning the toilet. And that's the one poem that she has really about a person. So no, she doesn't write about people very much. She also has written a couple of poems. She had a very much a rural background, as I did. She grew up in Ohio on a farm. I believe that, however, the sadness was she was sexually abused by her father. So that comes out in several of her poems. But she did have a good life in that rural community and friends, and she often skipped school and went out to the woods and wrote and read Walt Whitman instead of actually going to school. So that's part of the biography of her life. Someone else wanted to say? Rachel.
Hi. When you were talking about her relationship to the natural world and stuff, and I started to think about it, and I just realized that a piece of it also is can be in the sounds of nature as well as just observing and so forth. And I thought back to a very early time when I was about 4 years old, and I was with my grandmother, and she had an answer, a wonderful answer in Italian for everything. She had little proverbs that could explain any problem I had in life in Italian. But anyway... and I've sort of heard all these sounds all the time, and I said, what is that? And she said, oh, those are the cicadas, which is cicadas. And she said, that means it's going to be hot tomorrow. And I said, wow, you can tell from a sound of a little animal thing what the weather's going to be tomorrow. And that's like she had all this strange wisdom. But now whenever I hear the cicadas, I think of my grandmother and just how awesome these little creatures are. So, I don't know. Now the sound reminds me of our relationship or how special nature is in its own way.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for the service. I think Franny would have actually really liked to have been down here. I think, you know, you mentioned Whitman, which is great. Whitman's a favorite of mine. I also think a lot about Emily Dickinson, who's a favorite of our family. And we got to visit Emily Dickinson's home up in Northampton a few years ago, which I would recommend to anybody. It's an amazing tour. And at the end of the tour, they take you down to the tree in the yard by where Emily Dickinson used to garden. And they have her garden with all of the exact historical flowers that she used to garden, but this amazing tree that she used to sit under and read and possibly write some of her poetry, and the docent read a number of her poems under the tree. We were all sitting there. It was very beautiful. So I think that's an amazing experience. I think that poetry is such an essential part of, it should be an essential part of everyone's lives, and unfortunately it isn't always the case. I just think that it's so incredibly important. It's so wonderful. The other night, I was making dinner, and Frances was sitting there, and she motioned to a book that she had sitting next to her on the table, and she said, Mom, I started reading this. And I remembered that I had handed her this book a few weeks earlier. It was from a senior English seminar that I took in college, called The Literature and Poetry of World War I in Vietnam. And the book I'd handed her was this battered paperback. It was a Penguin anthology of World War I poetry, in which I'd written all these things in my fountain pen, which poems I thought were excellent and which ones I thought stunk. And she said, Mom, she opened it up and she said, there's this poem in here, and it's so incredible, and it's written by Wilfred Owen, and I just love it so much. And I was thinking, oh my God, because Wilfred Owen's like one of my favorite poets of all time, and that she just picked up this book and started reading it and was loving the poetry in it so much was just really, really touching to me. And I said to her, I said, don't just read, because she said you had a mark next to it saying this was a really good poem, and I said, don't just read the ones that I thought were good when I was 21 years old, but, you know, read any of them that you want to. And I want those things to get passed on from generation to generation because they really enrich people's lives.
I'm Elaine. I can understand this connection to nature and to our surroundings very well. I think it was on the day that 9/11, when I was walking to work, and it was such a beautiful day, and I was just enjoying it so immensely, and looking around, and it was so bright and lovely. The sky was so clear. And then, of course, the contrast of what happened. And then recently, I was in Brooklyn, and I stepped out on the stoop. And usually, I don't go out that way. But I looked down, and there was a dead darning needle on the stoop. And this is in the city. And we don't live far from Prospect Park, so I said, oh, it must be, you know, the darning needle came from Prospect Park, but how did it get on the stoop? And I took it, and I wanted to preserve its beauty. I was looking at it, and I put it in a little plastic box, and I said, I'm going to give it to my granddaughter. I thought she might be interested in seeing it closely and looking at it.
Say again what it was.
It was a darning needle, it was an insect, a big insect.
Oh,
oh, not a darning needle. Not this type of needle.
All right, it's an insect.
Exact.
Got it.
Okay, right, I'm sorry. I call it a darning needle. Might have another name. And I put it in a plastic box, and I was amazed at how long it was being preserved. It wasn't falling apart or anything. And just recently, when we had those storms, I was sitting in the living room, and I heard this. It sounded like someone was coming into my porch. And the first time I heard it, I just sat very still and quiet. Then I heard this noise again, and I said, let me go out and investigate. When I went out into the porch, and it's a closed-in porch, something flew at me. It seemed very large, and I noticed it had four wings. And then it flew to the other side of the room, and I went over to look at it. And I was amazed to see that it was a praying mantis, but a huge one. And I hadn't seen one of those since I had been a child. And I kept looking at it and staring at it and wondering. I'm saying, thinking, how can I get it out of here so it can survive? And I tried and I tried and I tried. I couldn't get it out. So I said, I hope it finds its way out. I haven't seen it since, but it was so beautiful. But I felt this connection to this to nature. You know, I've been feeling it more and more as I get older. I guess maybe there's something about it. Maybe I have more time to notice.
Thank you. And you too. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Pam Parker. Susan, first off, thank you. Obviously, there was a lot of effort and preparation and an awful lot of love that went into this, and it shows, and I'm grateful, and as you've heard, we're all grateful, so thank you. I thought you'd be amused to know that early in your talk, there was a little movement in the window, and it caught my eye, and there was a little chipmunk.
Uh-oh.
Sticking his head in, checking it out, like popping up about three times, and I said, okay, he knows, we're talking about him.
I cued him to come. Lita.
And of course, I have to thank you. It was absolutely a wonderful talk. And I really enjoyed it. And I related to it personally, which is very important with that kind of talk, as far as I'm concerned, anyway. Now, I just wanted to say that I am living in the house that my grandfather and other people built. And I remember, and we used to go there summers, and I remember feeling so wonderful as I'd go to sleep to the sound of the crickets. And I still have that feeling.
Yes. Well, not to be boring, but once again, thank you so much. It was a wonderful, inspirational talk, and I really also experienced it very personally and found it very uplifting. I also, at the risk of being depressing, it's interesting that that the point was brought up about her not writing about people. Because I can't help but think that this is kind of such a, you know, middle class kind of privileged kind of conversation that we're having. I think, you know, there are so many people whose lives are so hard and, you know, who, whether it's, you know, food insecurity or illness or trouble with children or, you know, whatever, that every day is a struggle to get through. And, you know, who don't
think about what am I going to do with my wonderful, precious life, you know, who just think, how am I going to survive each day, you know, and how am I going to put food on the table for my family? So I don't know. It just struck me as a kind of such a dichotomy of, you know, outlook and situation. So not to end on a depressing note, I just would share that I grew up in New York City, and if I go back now and I think, you know, to sleep there, it's like, it's so noisy, you know, I think, how did I ever sleep there? But I remember when I first moved up here, and the first night that I slept here, and I heard the crickets, and I thought, oh my God, how does anyone ever sleep with that noise? You know, I just was used to cars honking and everything, you know, that was okay. But the crickets, how can, it's all what you're used to, exactly. But thank you again. This was, you know, I guess that's what poetry is. It's not the everyday, you know, stuff. It lifts you up, and I am very grateful for your talk. It was wonderful.
Okay, she does have some activist poems, but not too many, and I didn't include those in the talk today, but if you do go and look through her poetry, you'll find a few, but that's not her major focus. But I think one of the things that she does say, which I think is proven out this morning, is how we all need to tell our stories and we all need to listen to each other's stories, and I think that was so beautifully done today in this sharing time. So now we have a way of closing.
Page 681, and we'll read it together. Deep peace of the running wave to you, deep peace of the flowing air to you, deep peace of the quiet earth to you, deep peace of the shining stars to you, deep peace of the infinite peace to you.